Hey everyone, we are recapping Chief of War Episode 8, so there may be spoilers ahead. If you'd like to skip the recap, feel free to jump ahead to right around the 3-minute, 30-second mark. Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode of Feathers and Fire.
What was the destiny of those who died? Our gods did not kill them. It was the foreign man and one ship, and they are coming back.
You are listening to Feathers and Fire, HPR's Chief of War After Show podcast. Thanks so much for joining us for deeper discussion and additional context to the Apple TV Plus series. I'm Russell Subiono.
Aloha mai, and I'm Mehana Makainai. Today we'll be discussing The Sacred New Grove, a heartbreaking episode that directly follows the tragic beach massacre and that brings up questions regarding death and burial traditions, as well as reestablishing pono, or balance, when things have gotten off course or gone terribly wrong. We'll get into these topics and more right after our episode recap.
So we open on the aftermath of the massacre at the end of episode 7. After assessing the losses, Kaʻiana and his family address Kamehameha and his council, blaming Kamehameha's inaction. This causes Kaʻiana to want to break from Kamehameha and return with his family to Kauai. We then see Nahi and Heke's romance bloom amongst the coconut trees in the Sacred New Grove, the same grove where Keoua and a band of warriors have come to kidnap the overseer to be a sacrifice. After Nahi and Heke are captured, Nahi engages with Keoua, but is defeated and killed. Heke is allowed to return to the village to deliver Keoua's message of war. Kaʻiana and Namake race off to the new grove, where they discover Nahi's body. They process his bones and entomb them on a high cliff.
We then cut back to Oahu, where Kahekili engages in another mind-altering ceremony. And in his altered state, he starts to tear down one of the structures he had built on the temple grounds. When his son Kupule tries to intervene, Kahekili stabs him.
Back on Hawaii Island, the news of the overseer's kidnapping and Nahi's death causes Kamehameha to initiate action against Keoua, but without Kaʻiana's help. Meanwhile, Kaʻiana and Namake plan to sneak into Kaʻu under cover of night to kill Keoua. Kubuohi then approaches Kamehameha at the Ahu, where she warns him he will not be able to defeat Keoua's army without the guns that Kaʻiana brought back from Zamboanga. Later that night, Kaʻiana meets with Kamehameha, who decides to use the guns to fight Keoua. The next morning, we see Kaʻiana teaching Kamehameha how to use a musket. Then we jump to the lava fields of Kaʻu, where we see Keoua's army training for war. Then a nearby volcano starts to erupt, shaking the ground and filling the air with ash and smoke. Keoua, as well as Kamehameha and Kaʻiana, see it as a sign that the gods are with the army in Kaʻu. We then cut to black.
Lots of stuff. Lots of hard things happening that we got to endure along with our characters.
Yeah.
And really, between these last two episodes, we've seen quite a bit of death. And it's been rough. We've had the murder of hundreds of Kanaka, as well as one of our lead characters. And I don't know about you, but I really liked Nahi.
Oh, I did too. I'm so sad he's gone.
As well, me as well. We've also seen warriors preparing for battle. And we know that when you go to war, lives will inevitably be lost. These scenes, as well as that of Kaʻiana's ohana, gently preparing Nahi's body and then burying him, which really was beautifully made, made Russell and I want to continue our conversation on Hawaiian traditions of death and burial, which we got into very slightly during episode 4 after the passing of Kalaniopuʻu. Today we figured let's turn our attention to iwikupuna, or the bones of our loved ones.
What I think Chief of War co-creators Paʻa Sibbett and Jason Momoa have done a good job of with the series is like shining the spotlight on important practices in our culture. We saw it with the succession of power ceremony after Kalaniopuʻu's death in episode 4, and we're seeing it here with the burial of Nahi. Honestly, I don't know that much about our burial practices. My parents didn't take us to many funerals when we were young, and I wasn't living in Hawaii when my grandmother passed away, so I missed all the protocols that my family went through. I do know that Eevee have so much significance in our culture to the point that if Eevee were discovered at a construction site, work must stop and the state must be notified so it can investigate whether it's a burial site or something else, which is what happened, right? It actually happened when Walmart tried to build its first store in Hawaii back in the early 2000s. So this episode made me very curious about the specifics of our cultural burial traditions.
So let's focus on Eevee, like you were mentioning, Eevee meaning our bones. And really, before we can discuss any type of burial practices in Hawaii, we need to talk about mana. And I'm not talking about your uncle mana or your best friend mana. If you live in Hawaii, we all know a mana, right, Russell?
Yeah, shout out to Mana Kaupana, one of my favorite cousins.
My brother-in-law, mana, and my nephew, Manawake Kai. We get plenty of them. I've got at least a dozen in my life. Popular name, and likely due to the meaning and cultural context of what mana is. So mana is a Hawaiian term that loosely translates to mean spiritual power or essence. We always got to be careful with translations because when we're trying to make sense of something in one culture that actually exists in another, it doesn't always work. So it's never going to be a perfect representation, but we can do our best with an explanation. In Hawaii, mana was inherited first through your genealogy. And we've talked about genealogy before in Chief of War. Everyone is born with the mana of our parents and grandparents and so forth back in time. For Hawaiians, it goes all the way back to the gods and the beginning of our universe. It's our connection to the past and the future. We honor those who came before and prepare for those who are coming. The idea was that you are connected to something so much greater than just yourself and that you have a kuleana, or responsibilities and privileges that tie us to our ohana, our communities, and our land.
And we see this concept of mana behind many of the familial and relational decisions made in the show. We also see it in Kalaniopuu Pu'u succession ceremony, right? Keaua calls Kamehameha lowborn, and we can probably assume that his perceived lesser mana is part of the reason why Keaua doesn't believe Kamehameha is worthy of stewardship of Kukaili Moku.
Yes, so everybody in traditional society was very familiar with their genealogy. Whether you were a Makaainana or you were an Ali'i, you had knowledge of who your ohana was. Kamakau, one of our most famous and renowned historians, said that often what determined the difference between an Ali'i, a chief, a mo'i, a ruler, and a Makaainana, someone who was the eyes of the land, the workers of the land, was full knowledge of your genealogy. So if you could go all the way back to the time of the gods, all the way back to the creation of our land, then that was that pure genealogy that essentially created all of that mana that you inherited. And so if you lost some of that information over time, your status, it would no longer be as high as it used to have been. So this is really important. We took a lot of care to preserve our knowledge, to pass it on, oftentimes through oli, through stories.
And that's why it's important today, right? When we ask, you know, like, who's your mana? Who's your father?
Yeah, we still see a local connection to that. And I believe that it's a wonderful thing. And it's also for us to have a way of like connecting. Like, yeah, I'm meeting you right now, but do I know you in the past?
Like,
do our families have connections?
Yeah.
And you and I, Russell, when we first met, we did that. And we found like Vahipana connections. Yeah. We found Ohana connections. And then we're like, okay, cool. Yeah. I can trust this person a little bit more now. Yeah. So this is something that was a really big deal. It can't be understated how important it was. Now, the second way mana was acquired was over the course of your lifetime, based on your actions and abilities. So for example, if you're a chief, you're an ali'i, being generous, protecting your people, having an abundance of food, facilitating healthy and happy communities, caring for the gods, all of these things would increase your mana and therefore that of your entire ohana, past into future. However, if you failed in these ways, the opposite would happen and you would decrease your mana and that of your entire ohana. And if you were a chief, you'd also likely be stoned to death and replaced with someone who had both the genealogy and ability to lead. No joke here. Happened multiple times in our history. Just two examples. We got Hakau of Waipio Valley, Hawaii Island. We've got Haka of Lihue Kauai. Both of them did not do a good job with their communities. The Makaainana, the eyes of the land, replaced them with someone who had both the genealogy and the ability. And mana is this way of holding us accountable.
Your description of mana, it almost kind of sounds like video games, you know, like
where are you going with this, Russell?
Like where a character can increase its life force by performing certain actions or acquiring certain items. There should be a Hawaiian video game where the goal is to increase the mana of a character, right? So like win a battle, mana goes up. Create lo'i, build a fish pond, mana goes up. But sleep with your brother's wife after he was kidnapped by British sailors and forced to travel around the Pacific, lose mana. Nah, just kidding. I'm all good with namake.
Or maybe elevate mana because next generation is looking good.
Well, that's a good point. Elevate your kids' mana. Yeah.
So now that we understand what mana is and we're looking at it from a historical context, from how we've seen it in Chief of War as well, and from Russell's proposed video game, okay, the question becomes, where does our mana reside? Like, where is it? And the answer is everywhere. It exudes from our bodies through things like our hair, our nails, even our feces.
What?
I know that might sound a little gross, but chiefs actually had special retainers that would collect and then hide their feces. Hmm. Do you have any ohana, Russell, that like bury their nails or their hair?
I don't know. This is actually the first time I've heard about hair and nails being buried. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be at a funeral. So while you're alive, when you cut your hair, when you cut your nails, traditionally, and many people still today, will gather those items, will bury them, will protect them. And the reason we did things like that, including like the excrements of our chiefs, is because everything that comes off of you has your mana. And we believe that it needed to be respected, it needed to be honored, and we needed to dispose of it appropriately. Because if you don't, somebody who doesn't like you might be able to take those things and prey harm upon you. Or maybe they'll take them and they'll create something out of it and try and steal your mana. We have stories about bones of expert fishermen. After they die, people try and find their bones to make fish hooks out of them. Because they're like, oh, I want to use this man's mana to go and be able to catch fish out of the sea. Now, if that's your ohana, maybe it's appropriate and that's fine. If that's just somebody you don't know, maybe you don't want them using your bones to catch their dinner, right? So we took very specific precautions to always protect ourselves, to protect our mana, to protect what we're creating. It's also likely that the cleanliness of our society, like we talked about in a past episode that Cook's crew members used to write about in their journals, that this was also tied to our beliefs and practices associated with mana, because care was put into everything that we did. Now, after we died, Hawaiians believe that the final resting place of our mana is in our bones, which we call our iwi kupuna. As a result, in preparing the body for burial, the flesh would be melted away and the bones preserved. The bones would then be cleaned and wrapped, usually in kapa, which is our bark cloth made out of wauke, and sometimes placed in a container, such as one woven out of lauhala or other types of materials. Then the bones would be taken and they would be hidden. So they would be put in secrecy. Many of us are accustomed to maybe going to cemeteries today, visiting our loved ones, putting flowers there, maybe spending some time there. This is not how we did it in Hawaii. Instead, we hid the remains of our ancestors so that we would allow their bones to return to the aina that they came from, to return to the land that they came from, and to become a part of Hawaii again.
The series kind of devotes quite a bit of screen time to Nahi's burial and death, and we see these bones being cared for by Namake and then Ka'iana scaling this tall cliff and finding a space between a large rock where his bones would not be disturbed. I don't really know a whole lot about the locations where bones were typically laid to rest, but I've heard stories of caves within the walls of Waipio Valley where certain chiefs' bones were laid. I know burial sites have been found within caves deep in the forests of the Big Island and other islands. And I know that when the city and county of Honolulu tried to clear land to build a park near the shoreline of Hunana Niho, Sherwood's Beach, the community blocked the entrance to the beach to protect the iwi kupuna buried in the area. So clearly the care of iwi is important to our people, right?
And you're correct. Some of the common areas for burial would include sea cliffs. Why sea cliffs? Like they showed in Chief of War? Yeah. Because they're hard to get to.
Yeah.
And it's not like people are just going to be hanging out in those areas. So it's a nice final resting place. It's going to take a while for those bones to disintegrate. So it gives them probably that time that they need. Something kind of cool in regards to these practices also is that if you had a chief, an ali'i of a very high rank, very beloved by his community or her community, oftentimes these bones, after they were hidden, the person tasked with that kuleana, with that responsibility, sometimes they would do things like cut out their tongue after, or sometimes they would even commit suicide so that the final resting place of this ali'i would die with them as well.
Yeah.
And no one would ever know. So the secrecy was that important and that honored to us. Sand dunes, you know, different areas. A lot of times people, we wanted to be buried where we lived, where we were born, because it makes sense. We had land affinity, right? You're so deeply tied to the Aina that you come from. And it means that your ancestors will always be around you in a way, right? So yeah, this hiding of our bones, it might be peculiar to other customs and cultures, but to us, it was completely the norm and what was done in everyday life. Another topic this episode inspired was a look at reestablishing pono, our balance, which I think kind of our Ivi Kupuna discussion talks about that too, ways to reestablish pono and balance. And in this episode, it is out of whack for a majority of the time. We already identified that there's a ton of death that's happening. People are confused, they're upset, they're mourning. And this rift between Kamehameha and Ka'iana almost seems unfixable. The loss is just too great. But then the women step in.
And this totally caught me off guard until that glance that Kupo he gives Ka'ahumanu as Ka'iana teaches Kamehameha how to shoot a musket. But then again, right, it was meant to fly below their men's radar, so it was probably written to fly below mine. Did you pick up on the revelation at the end of the episode, or did you see it
what
the whole time?
Are you really going to ask me?
You probably saw it the whole time.
Hello, they're meeting up in the grove where Ka'ahumanu is frustrated, and she's flinging her slingshot at the trees, and they're kind of like exchanging what's going on and giving each other looks, like they were setting it up. And then Ka'ahumanu immediately goes and she's talking to Ka'iana and trying to give him some advice about, you know, don't let Nahi's death kill you. Instead, like, live for Nahi.
Yeah.
And then you got Kupu'ohi going to Kamehameha and telling him, hey, you're going to fight this battle, you're going to lose. If you want to win, let the red-mouthed weapons be the voice of Ku. And she turns around and she kind of smirks as she walks away because she's like, got him, you know? So no, they were building it up. These women knew what they were doing. It was wonderful. They were incredibly cunning and deliberate. And in the best possible ways, right? They work together very well. They're able to remedy the immediate problem at hand, which is that Kamehameha and Ka'iana are different pages. And neither will be successful without the other. It's a fact, and they know it. And they're able to bring these very stubborn, set in their way, men to come to an agreement.
Yeah, very sneaky. But I also think that's the hallmark of a good wife or a good partner, right? The ability to know which buttons to push in order to get a desired result, but only if they use their powers for good.
Yeah, sneaky. I don't know if I like that word. Like, let's say very...
Purposeful.
Purposeful. Yeah, thoughtful. Deliberate. Yeah, all those wonderful things.
I imagine I've probably been manipulated. Well, maybe manipulated is a strong word, but... I've probably been unknowingly influenced by my wife on many occasions, probably for the benefit of my kids. If I was, I'm sure I wasn't aware at the time.
Yeah, and that's why she did it so well. And just like Kamehameha and Ka'iana and Chief of War, they're never going to know or recognize that it was Kupu'ohi and Ka'ahumanu that saved their lives in this instance and brought them together. The women are, they're fine. They know. They can go to their halepe'a. They're going to talk about it later. Now, these scenes and the role of Kupu'ohi and Ka'ahumanu made me think of some of the teachings of Auntie Kale Nu'uhiva. Auntie Kale is an amazing Hawaiian scholar. She's a kilolani, or a watcher and predictor of the weather. She studies the Kaulana Mahina, or the Hawaiian moon calendar, and just has so much cool knowledge that she provides to our communities. If you ever have a chance to talk story or learn from Auntie Kale Nu'uhiwa, do not miss that opportunity. Among other things, I learned from Auntie Kale that women were responsible in traditional Hawaiian society for reestablishing pono, our topic, or balance if something was off, that women were often the catalyst for change. And we have countless stories that support this, such as all of our stories connected to Hina. So Hina is a Hawaiian, a female goddess who we often find in the moon, as well as in the reef, among other places. Anytime she shows up in an oli, in a chant, in a story, there will be a pivot. There'll be a moment of change. So she signifies that, a redirection that sets a new course. Another example would be our goddess Haumea. Haumea is our goddess of childbirth, the goddess of procreation. In our stories, it's said that a piece of Haumea is reborn in every generation of women, of Hawaiian women. So Haumea lives in me, Haumea lives in my daughters. So kind of cool. But in Haumea's stories also, she's often kind of calculating and figuring things out and redirecting things. In one of her stories, she has a lover, Wakea. And in this story, Haumea actually, she's down at the ocean, she's in the reef, because the deep sea was the domain of men, but the reef areas was an extension of land. So women would gather delicacies, things like that. And she was doing some things and she saw omens that Wakea was in trouble. And so she ran back to their home and she found that he had been bound and he was going to be killed because he broke a kapu. And the kapu was to not eat bananas. And she, in her mind, she's like, this is the stupidest couple I ever heard. There's bananas everywhere. I'm looking at all these bananas right now. And she was really upset, but she was smarter than that. She's not going to go in and just go off at everybody. Instead, she went in and said, oh, I'm so sorry. My lover broke your rules. And please, chief, may I just embrace him one last time before you kill him? And what do you think he said, Russell? What would you say if I said, I'm so sorry. Can I please give him one last hug?
Yes, of course, please.
Gotcha. So she goes up to Wakea, throws her arms around him. And in this version of the story, he's tied to an ulu tree. And an ulu tree, or breadfruit, is actually one of her kinolau, her manifestations. So they disappear into it and they run off into the forest. And the chief is like, oh my gosh, this wahine, she went trick me. It happens. Okay. Yeah. So what we see in that story is, again, this woman being this catalyst of change, being this protector, sometimes being able to see things that the men can't. And men and women have different kuleana. And this is one of ours. And so I really loved how Chief of War, whether it was intended or not, kind of played into these very distinguishing characteristics of women and our roles. I saw it as being incredibly culturally appropriate. And it was a clever inclusion that pays tribute again to what our wahine were able to offer, past to present.
I get the sense that it was an intentional choice by the writers. If this series was made like 60, 70 years ago, the women characters might have been depicted as being incapable or totally dependent on the men. But today, it's refreshing to see the female characters in Chief of War, while still sensitive and vulnerable, have avenues for their own agency as well. I think that's what we admire so much about Kupu'ohi and Kaahumanu.
And I think it's also one of the areas that make the series more historically accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking at these women from this really strong role that they did play and the advice that they offered and that was taken by the men.
All right. We'll be right back after a short break.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
All right, let's get into the categories. Most impactful or chicken skin moment?
So we probably had what I would consider our saddest moment so far in Chief of War, when Ka'iana and Namake are running to the new grove to find Nahi and they discover his body. And Kaʻiana immediately removes the stone and pulls Nahi to him and just cries while hugging him. And then Namake covers them both with his arms. It was a scene of unconditional love that showed their strong pilina or relationship to one another. It was so sad and so moving. And even the fact that Kaʻiana is just, he keeps saying Nahi, Nahi, yeah, you yeah. know, and he refers to him as Kuʻu Nahi, my beloved Nahi. And I just thought it was so beautiful and heartbreaking, and aloha ino to their family.
The scene that impacted me the most was part of Nahi's burial ceremony. It's the burial atop the sea cliffs. Nahi was one of my favorite characters, so I'm grieving alongside everybody else. But what really drives it home is that I also have two brothers, and I'm the oldest. We're all 2 years apart. So that's in the back of my head as Kaʻiana and Namake mourn and go through the burial ceremony, and as Kaʻiana swears justice and then wails as loud as he can. That scene just got me good too.
It was a good one. And I think you bring up another good point that we didn't mention in our discussion on Iwi Kupuna, which is if you are hiking, if you come across Iwi Kupuna, leave them alone.
Yeah.
And don't go out of your way to try and look for the bones of our ancestors. Well, they might come looking for you, you know? But leave them alone. Be respectful of these sites. Know that our land everywhere is very sacred, and try to do your best to do as little harm and impact as possible.
Next category, character that brought the most heat or the performance we really liked.
I'm going to go with Heke, played by Maine Kinimaka. She brought a ton of emotion to the episode and a lot of diversity as well from start to finish. She was involved in a really difficult scene where we experienced the murder, as we stated, of our beloved Nahi. And you could feel everything that her character was going through. So yes, Heke, definitely my choice for bringing that tragic heat to this episode.
For me, man, I can't get enough of Cliff Curtis as Keaʻua. Depraved, I think, is a word that I think of when I watch his character in this show. His work is at such a high level right now. Also, I'm not saying that he's the Polynesian Robert De Niro, but when you combine his incredible acting skill and some of the expressions that we see on Keaʻua's face, he does kind of flash De Niro to me a little bit.
Is this like the third time you've chosen him?
Yeah, I think so. I'm just enamored with his performance. Next category, most questionable moment or moment that raised questions or the moment that needs more explanation.
I'm going to go with the scene where Kahikili is like losing it. It was kind of shocking, and he's really taken on very like villainous attributes by this point in the story, and then he stabs his son who he loves. So it was all a bit weird, and so I'm like, that's kind of my questionable moment.
Yeah, his story arc has taken a turn for the weird for sure. For me, I'm very curious about the scene toward the end where Heke spots the fisherman in the river, and the fisherman is picking a flower from a nearby plant. Then he grinds it up and places it underwater near a rock. And whatever the fisherman did apparently either paralyzed or killed the fish in the river. I'm curious what that plant is, because once the fisherman went his way, Heke immediately picked the same flower for some yet undetermined, dark, shadowy purpose.
Oh, you know what that purpose is.
My guess is that she wants to put it in Keaʻua's mouth. No, wait, Opudui.
Oh, it's got to be revenge.
Yeah.
She is preparing. Remember, women are incredibly methodical, so we plan ahead.
Yeah.
She is making sure that whatever situation comes up and whenever she has the opportunity, she will be makaukau. She will be ready. And I really enjoyed this inclusion because Heke's always been someone who is fascinated with plants.
Yeah.
And she's our la'au lapa'au person. Yeah. And that is using plants for medicinal purposes. So she's expanding her knowledge now. And she's seeing that, you know, the plants can also be used for this kind of deadly way. And so her character is evolving a bit. As we saw in an episode or two before, she's also becoming a warrior, right? She wants to learn how to fight. Yeah. So yeah, get it, girl.
Next category, the Kainamakua Memorial Best Line from the episode.
I had a hard time with this one. Yeah. There's a lot of good lines in this episode and some one-liners that I really love, like kunahi, you know, or two words only. But I'm going to take us back to the opening scene where Ka'iana is hugging Vai's son on the beach and he sees the arrival of Kamehameha in his court and anger. He goes from sadness to anger instantaneously, right? He gets up, starts charging at Kamehameha, and all of a sudden Kupuohi interferes and she appears in front of him and she says, Ka'iana, not here, not here. These people need our help.
Ka'iana! Ka'iana! Kayana! Not here. Not here. These people need our help.
And he looks at her, and his rage immediately kind of disappears. He's still frustrated, but she's able to get through to him. And they turn around, they walk away together holding hands. And I just thought it was a great, emotional, impactful scene with a strong line coming from our leading female character, one of our leading female characters. And it was also refreshing to see Kupuohi still able to calm him and center him again.
For me, honestly, I think Opunui has the best line in this episode. It's aimed at Nahi, and Opunui says in so many words that the stench of traitor Nahi reeks like his sweaty malo, right? And that's the PG version of it. 20-year-old me finds it hilarious, but 40-plus-year-old me now kind of finds it crass. But it's still 100% true to character for the bloodthirsty and abrasive Opunui. So a very well-written line.
And a 40-year-old Malo is probably a little worse than a 20-year-old
Malo. Yeah, I think it's Hauna.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great line. And I think it also plays into Hawaiians were really witty with their words. And we like to do this kind of back and forth kind of games where we would throw like kauna filled insults at one another. And then you got to come back at it. Yeah. So Opunui's on his game.
All right. The Meredith Artley Most Momoa Moment.
Oh, man, these are hard categories this week because I felt like these episodes had everything from sadness to anger to excitement, you know, but I'm going to go with the seriously prepared Momoa moment. So when Ka'iana is teaching Kamehameha how to shoot the red-mouthed weapons at the very end of the episode, it's like he's been doing this all his life, right? He grabs the gun. He's like, boom. And he looks at Kamehameha with a stern face, passes it to him. Like, he's just this, I've known it all. I created the gun. This is my weapon. Here you go. And I liked it. I thought it was very confident. And this is the episode leading up to our season finale. So now we're like, we absolutely know that we're headed into battle.
Very Momoa moment. And there were so many in this episode and such a wide range of them too, right? From fierce Momoa to heartbroken Momoa. And he's better than I've ever seen him in these moments. But I'm going to choose the moment where Ka'iana confronts Kamehameha and the council about the massacre. I feel like it's an extra strength Momoa moment because not only is Ka'iana's anger over what happened coming through, but I also kind of feel like Jason's anger over historic deaths of Hawaiians is kind of in there as well.
The death of these Kanaka are on your hands. Dare put the blame on this council. No one could know what would happen. I did kill Moku.
And I think Chief of War is a storyline that's very personal to most of the actors and actresses.
What prop or artifact would you want from this episode?
I've been feeling Kaiana's necklace for a while now. Not exactly sure what it's made of, but I'm into it. So I'm going to go with that.
Yeah, I've been curious about it as well. And we got a listener email asking about it too. So if anybody knows what it is, please send an email to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org so that we can explain it on the next podcast episode. For me, I want that backpack, that backpack that Kaiana used to take Nahi's bones to his tomb on the top of the cliff. I don't know if it's only a ceremonial type of thing. I just think it's so cool. Plus, I read somewhere that Hawaiians are an indigenous culture that never integrated the use of the wheel. But I say, so what? We had awesome backpacks.
Why does that even matter? We had the canoe.
Yeah.
We could get places way faster. When I've seen burial items, I've never seen like a backpack style. So I wonder if it was kind of a play on different things or if they really existed. I've seen more like umeke style, where it's woven and it has a lid that goes over it and the bones go into that. But yeah, it was a really cool piece. And I think maybe if it wasn't something that was based on something in Hawaii, maybe they took some stuff from Aotearoa there.
Yeah, and it made sense, right? It was a practical use of an item for a specific purpose. And our people are smart. We would have figured it out. All right. Who won the episode?
Hands down. Ka'ahumanu and Kupuohi. The Manawahine duo conquered this episode. I love their relationship that has developed and how they rely on one another to get things done.
For me, it's Kamehameha forced into action. It's a relief to finally see him get it, right? To see what Kaiana sees. There's a little sadness too, though, because it's almost like the end of innocence for Kamehameha. But it's high time in this narrative that the prophesied one embraces his role. And so now that Kamehameha has been called to action, we'll get to see him in battle, and I'm super excited to finally see him fight.
Yeah, me too. Kamehameha has been portrayed as very peaceful and very kind of contemplative, and yeah, I think those were attributes of him, but I also think of Kamehameha as this fierce warrior.
Yeah,
so let's bring out some of that.
All right, our last category, our hot take or prediction for the next episode or the series finale.
Okay, season finale, guys, we've arrived, and I predict the epic battle between Kiowa with the aid of Maui chiefs and Kamehameha Kaiana and their loyal forces. I'm team Kamehameha Kaiana and Kupuohi, so I'll be rooting for them. Pretty much my same prediction I made the last episode.
The final episode is titled The Black Desert. So we're going to see that epic battle on the barren black lava fields in Kau. I'm also rooting for Kamehameha and Kaiana. I know those scenes were filmed on my home island of Hawaii Island, so I'm predicting that I'll recognize some faces amongst the background extras. I'm also going to go out on a limb and say that a third party, an interloper, will have an impact on the outcome of the battle, whether it's the Nootka appearing out of nowhere or Mauna Loa having a huge explosion, or maybe Kauai Chief Kaumualii, played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson, making a cameo, or some other entity that we didn't see coming. Also,
you're taking that same stuff Kahikili was taking, huh, Russell?
Probably, right? The nightmare fish. Also, I know I said early on that I wouldn't be surprised if Temuera Morrison got an Emmy nomination for Kahikili, but I withdraw that prediction. I am now predicting that Cliff Curtis finally gets his due and wins the Emmy for actor in a supporting role. You heard
Cliff,
it here.
You heard it here.
Yeah.
Russell wants to be your plus one.
I'll carry your suitcase for you, Cliff. All right. Next week, Moses Goods will be joining us as our special guest in the finale episode. He's the local actor who plays Ke'eau Moku. Today, we are excited to hear from Chief of War star and co-creator Jason Momoa and co-creator and head writer Thomas Pa'asibit. Now, before you get too excited, I wasn't able to talk to them in person, but HBR culture and arts reporter Cassia Ordonio did talk to them in person at the Chief of War world premiere in Kapolei. And she got a great candid response from Jason about some of the cinematic acting choices that he's come to be known for.
At any point along the way, did you ever feel like it was destiny, like this work was the one thing you were born to do?
I gotta tell you, even being here right now, these were the hopes and dreams that someday this would happen, but it's still kind of like, I don't believe that it's happening. If that makes sense, it's such a far out, I can't believe it's made on this level, at the height of this level. It's kind of just, sometimes it feels like it's not even me, or like, I don't really, it's a bit of a, everything's stacked up to this moment. You know, we have 15 years of working together, doing movies together, him helping me with roles, Aquaman, I mean, there's numerous of things, a career so strengthened and to the point where now we're leading this charge to make something for our ancestors and for our people. It's kind of like, am I destined to do it? I'm honored to do it. I don't, I'm just excited that people get to see, you know, the next generation, our kids get to see us up there on the big screen and our stories. If I'm a vehicle for it, let it just be so now there's a door and let everybody else kick it down, because we have so many things to tell. Yeah. So it's like, whatever we may not have done, I hope it inspires the next generation. Like, you know, our cousins in Aotearoa, you know, we had Once From Warriors, we had some Whale Rider, we had some movies that were at least Polynesia that we could look up to, but pretty.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's it. We wanted to make something that we wished we had when we were younger. We wanted to make something that could enable, as Jason says, just this next generation, or even to inspire kupuna that have never seen these things. Like, you know, my parents have never seen any of this stuff in real time. My grandparents never saw it. It was taken away. It was pulled to the side. We were pushed to a corner too. So just to have something, you know, that we would have wanted, I think it has a big impact.
And for you, Pa'a, yeah. I think Hawaiian history is complicated. Maybe all history is complicated.
Right.
Doing surface level internet research on Kaiana and the story of Chief of War is telling, and at times seemed complex, and other times it seemed like there were gaps in history, the historical record, or conflicting information. How were you able to sort through everything and identify the key storylines that became the foundation of the story?
Yeah, well, I think when it comes to trying to do any endeavor, if you're trying to tell any form of history, the truth is it shouldn't begin when you say, hey, let's build this story. If I have 2 months to study a history I don't know, I just wouldn't be the right guy to do it. So the truth is the preparation began at childhood. I mean, these are stories that are shared around, you know, dinner tables, campfires. This is grandma's words. This is my uncle's passion. You know, these are things that you hear. And so the study starts from a really young age. So when it came to us building this, it wasn't just a matter of like, hey, we should research everything, you know, and try to get it all right now. It was like, dude, you know, the story that people have talked about, or, you know, this thing, like, now we come from a place where we've already got a good base of culture, history, and respect. Now we dig deeper, and we can go deeper than anybody else could, because nobody had the base to start.
When you were writing Chief of War, how did you balance being true to history with being a little bit more imaginative to create compelling characters and plot lines?
Well, so at the core of it, you know, Jason and I are filmmakers, we're writers, and, you know, we are creatives, right? But I will tell you this, watch it. You could do the research, you'll find out how much of this is actually true. I mean, it is, like I said, the base for us wasn't hearing about a story for the first time and start researching for 2 months and writing a show. The history for us goes way back. I'm a Hawaiian studies major. It's my passion. It's what I do. I do it on my free time. I don't profess to be a historian, but I will tell you that with the exception of really crunching chronology and maybe moving some events around, everything is rooted in something. And that's what's exciting for us, right? Because we are telling a story from the inside out. Yeah, creatively, obviously we had to fill in gaps. We don't know what characters were thinking. We don't always know what their motivations are, but we know what they did. And when you know what they did, you can reverse engineer that and cause motive and desire, attention, all of that, all the things that work.
Question for you, Jason. One of the things that makes you an admired actor is you know how to make the most of the camera. And I've heard stories of what the cast and crew call the J-turn, that really cool move you do when you turn to face the camera. It's your signature move. I've seen some clips from Chief of War.
I hate that move, man. That's a James Wan goddamn turn. They're like, permission to come aboard. I hate that move. It's a cheesy ass. Everyone wants you to do that move. It's just,
it works, though, bro.
Oh, bro, I don't want that. No, but I look. No. Oh, no, man.
Your blue steel.
Oh, my God.
Magnum.
The J look.
first, First of all, how dare them?
No!
How dare them?
God, I can't stand it.
J-Lib.
Wow. Oh, man.
That's the quote. It well, almost seems like...
Just to let those people know they're fired. It's not in my episode, I'll say that much.
And that's it for this episode of Feathers and Fire, HPR's Chief of War After Show podcast. I'm Russell Subiono.
I'm Mehana Makainai. Thanks so much for listening.
This episode was written by myself and Mehana and produced by me and Savannah Harriman-Pope.
Mahalo to our support team of Liberty Peralta, Sylvia Flores, and Sophia McCullough.
Thank you to HPR's president and CEO, Meredith Artley, who is currently campaigning to be the president of the Feathers and Fire fan club.
Oh, yeah. Our theme song is Clarity by Kenny Endo from the album Eternal Energy. Learn more about Kenny and his music, as well as his traditional and contemporary Japanese drumming school, Taiko Center of the Pacific, at kennyendo.com.
Our next episode, we'll discuss episode 9, the season finale of Chief of War, titled The Black Desert. And this has come really fast, yeah.
It sure has.
You can download our podcast episode on Saturday, September 20th from Apple, Spotify, or the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org/podcasts. I'm Russell Subiono. Aloha and mahalo nui for listening.
I'm Mehana Makainai, and until next time, pipi holo ka'au.